Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 42. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. In this episode, we continue our investigation into monetary systems and the inner workings of privatized banking. Our money system is not what we've been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. Not only is virtually the entire money supply created privately by banks, but a mere handful of very big banks is responsible for a massive investment scheme known as derivatives, which now tallies in at the hundreds of trillions of dollars. The banking system has been contrived so that these big banks always get bailed out by the taxpayers from their risky ventures. But the scheme has reached its mathematical limits. There isn't enough money in the entire global economy to bail out the banks from a massive derivatives default today. When the investors realize that the insurance against catastrophe that they have purchased in the form of derivatives is worthless, they are liable to jump ship and bring the whole shaky edifice crashing down. Web of Debt unravels the deceptions in our money scheme and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. Then it explores a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. If you care about financial security, your own or the nation's, you should read this book. Ellen Brown developed her research skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. In Web of Debt, her latest book, she turns those skills to an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the Money Trust. She shows how this private cartel has usurped the power to create money from the people themselves and how we the people can get it back. Brown developed an interest in the developing world and its problems while living abroad for 11 years in Kenya, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. She returned to practice law when she was asked to join the legal team of a popular Tijuana healer with an innovative cancer therapy who is targeted by the chemotherapy industry in the 1990s. That experience produced her book, Forbidden Medicine, which traces suppression of natural health treatments to the same corrupting influences that have captured the money system. Brown's 11 books include the best-selling Nature's Pharmacy, co-authored with Dr. Lynn Walker, which has sold over 285,000 copies. Her website is www.webofdebt.com. Upcoming shows. Next week, I'll be speaking with Judith Ann Brown, author of John Marco Allegro, The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and she is also the daughter of John Marco Allegro. Also coming up a week after that will be Daniel Siebert, who will be on to discuss Salvia Divinorum. And the following week, I hope to have Dr. Richard Tarnas on, who is the author of Passion of the Western Mind, as well as other books. And following him will be part two of Stephen Zerlinga's interview from the American Monetary Institute. And let's see. Pretty much sums it up right now. I'm still working on a couple of other guests that I've mentioned recently on previous shows. And this show is listener-sponsored, so if you enjoy this show and talk about it and share it with your friends and family, please don't hesitate to donate. It is your support we need, and we're really in need of donations this month. We haven't really had any donations for the last couple of weeks, so your support is greatly appreciated, and many of the projects and shows that we do here at Gnostic Media do require your support, and the production is greatly aided when we have money. It does get kind of expensive to produce these and acquire the books and materials and keep everything going on a weekly basis, so your help is very much appreciated. And we can also still use volunteers for the transcripts. We've gotten many of them done, but we still have more to do, so please contact me right away about that. And to support this show, you can also go to the Gnostic Media website and order a copy of my DVD or one of the books. And also don't forget to check out the She Who Remembers or SWR archives when you're on the Gnostic Media website. And I've got about 23 copies left of the color, numbered, and signed edition remaining of Astrotheology and Shamanism. So make sure you get a copy of that before they're gone. And I also have copies remaining of the first edition, first printing of The Holy Mushroom. So don't forget to get that. The one available on Amazon now is the second printing. So do be aware of that. And that pretty much sums everything up, except lastly, the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. And if you'd like to go to the website, once again, that's www.gnosticmedia.com, GNOSTICmedia.com, and you can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Enjoy the interview. Ellen, welcome to Gnostic Media's podcast. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you.
What is your educational background?
I have a bachelor's degree in English literature from Berkeley, UC Berkeley, and a JD, Juris Doctor, from UCLA Law School. So I'm a lawyer. And I went to several places in between. I went to the University of Leeds for a year, and in England, and the I started at University of Colorado.
So you've got a little bit of educational background there.
Yeah, but you know, I'm really a writer in search of a subject.
Yeah, you know,
I was going to be a writer. I just couldn't support myself as a writer, so I went to law school. And when I was 29, I could see I wasn't going to support myself as a writer, so I went to law school.
I was just going to add, yeah, which you ended up supporting yourself as a writer, it looks like.
Well, yeah, and as I got older, but there's not much you can do with an English degree except teach, and I didn't want to teach. But you can be a lawyer because there's a lot of writing involved in law. And so I was a litigator, which is you write briefs, which is argument, which is fun. So it's research and writing. That was the part I liked. I avoided going to court like the plague, you know, and I relied totally on my papers. What I like to do is stand up and say, I rely on my papers. I'd sit back down.
Well, that's quite a change to go from an English major to a doctor of law, to say the least. So, what was your life growing up as a child? Did you ever have any inclinations about what you write about today, or what was it like growing up for you?
Well, it was actually in my 20s. Oh, well, when I was, my hero as a young person was Abraham Lincoln. I used to, my relatives are from Pennsylvania. My mother's from Pennsylvania. And so we used to hang around the graveyards and go to Gettysburg and stuff like that. So I had this whole vision in my head of the Civil War. And for some reason, I just was taken with Abe Lincoln. So it's kind of funny that I wrote about that. And then my parents, of course, went through the Depression, and my father definitely was a Depression-era child. He was the oldest of seven and supported the family on a paper route when my grandfather was out of work, and my grandmother died she was pregnant with her eighth, and they didn't have money for food. I mean, it was quite quite difficult, so I sort of grew up hearing all those stories. That was in Michigan and Detroit and you know, General Motors and Ford Motor Company. But it was in my 20s that when I was trying to be a writer, that I, before I went to law school, I read on all the subjects that interested me. And the three things that I wanted to write about, one was health and nutrition, because I wasn't very healthy and I was looking for it. And one was economics, right? The whole banking thing. I had read something about the Federal Reserve, but at that age, I couldn't get to the end of it. You know, you'd go to the library and you'd read what was in there, and then the book you needed was missing, or you'd have some question and there was just no way to find the answer. So I couldn't really pursue that until my family went in the Foreign Service. My ex-husband and two kids, we all went in the Foreign Service for 11 years. And when I came back in 2000, all of a sudden with the internet, that whole field opened up, and suddenly all the answers were there. You could just pose a question and it would pop up on the internet. And then the third thing was spirituality, or just like basically what are we doing here and what are we supposed to be doing? What happens when we die? All that. It seemed to me you needed to know those things before you struck out in life.
Yeah, maybe, you know, and well, you've written 11 books, and the subject of our discussion today is just one of them. What were the titles of some of the other 10?
My first 10 were all on health, and then I got into the politics of health. Then I wrote one called Forbidden Medicine on, it was a lawsuit I worked on, defending an alternative cancer therapist in Tijuana who was kidnapped from his clinic by the FBI, taken to Brownsville, Texas, tried for fraud. The alleged fraud being that somebody working for him said that he had a high rate of cure for cancer. So this is something a word you're not allowed to use if you're not an MD, is cure. Well, it wasn't even him. It was somebody working.
Even though he was
in Utah referring patients to him. So it was like a very tenuous connection, and they called it a conspiracy to defraud.
So since when does the FBI have jurisdiction in Tijuana?
Well, that's a very good question.
Isn't the FBI...
And what about extradition? They didn't do any of those proper things. But the judge said, oh, well, he's here now. That's a moot point. So that defense didn't work.
Wow.
I mean, he wound up in jail for 2 years that time, and then another year and a half after they caught him. You know, well, they made him stay in Louisiana after he got out of jail. And all his old patients came to him, and they said they were going to die if he didn't treat them and all that. So, of course, he did, in violation of his probation. So after 5 years of probation, right when it was just about over, they nabbed him, and he wound up in jail again for a year and a half.
Yeah, I interviewed someone recently for my show, Rick Simpson from Canada, who has actually found a cure for cancer and has got a couple thousand people that are willing to testify on his behalf. And the Canadian government is doing everything possible to shut him up.
Actually, I wrote that book in the hopes of getting it. I dashed it out in the hopes of getting it in front of the judge. But then, of course, they wouldn't let the judge see it. There were a lot of things that we had floods of patient letters. I don't think the judge saw those either.
So your is it your latest book, Web of Debt?
Yeah, so the way I jumped over from health into that, of course, I had been interested, like I said, anyway, and then when I came back, I just found this whole issue, and it all opened up, and all the answers opened up. But also, it was Ed Griffin's book, World Without Cancer. It was a movie and a book, and it connected the pharmaceutical cartel with the banking cartel. And the oil cartel, they were all the same thing. They were going back to the Rockefellers and the Morgans of the 19th century, the robber barons, you know, the 19th century. So that was just very insightful and eye-opening. And having read that, it seemed to me that before you could solve the pharmaceutical problem or the control of corporations over the country, where they got their control was by creating the money supply. And so the first thing you had to do was get back the power to create money for the people themselves.
Well, you know, and I was just explaining that to a friend of mine yesterday about if you want to, you know, there's the whole issue with industrial hemp, and Andrew Mellon was behind that, a banker, as was William Randolph Hearst, and bringing back industrial hemp and getting the feds to stop playing with medical marijuana patients or arresting them. And then you have, you know, this whole money system that's designed around war, and you have the entire social services issues, hospitals, everything from building roads and keeping up bridges and Louisiana and the dikes can certainly be another issue there. But, you know, the banking system is behind all of these major issues that people are protesting, you know, and including the IMF and World Bank and the Bilderbergers and all of this stuff. And without this banking system in place, the rest of their mechanism completely falls apart. And I described it to somebody yesterday. It's like a wheel on a hub, and it, you know, the bank is like the cotter pin holding the wheel on the hub, and all you have to do is pull that cotter pin out. If we can get it through Congress, if you can pull that cotter pin out, the rest of their whole mechanism falls apart. Their whole
that's
new
great. That's yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking. That's why I got into that. Yeah.
But
great to meet you.
But, you know, and that's something that I've been realizing recently. And, you know, and I write, like you do, I write books on the origins of religion and things like that, and going into a lot of the occult stuff behind religions and how they manipulate the stories as being a lot of times literal when they're in fact myth or legend and things like that. And people are manipulated by these religious aspects. But it wasn't until recently that I really started seeing banking as another, if not even more important, key factor behind what makes the New World Order operate. But I wanted to mention something about the name of your book and the image on the front cover, which is a picture of the Federal Reserve is a big spider that's wrapped a web around the world, and to describe it for the listeners. But I find the title of your book very interesting because I first came across the idea of the Federal Reserve being, as I used to call it, a spider with long legs that extend forever with our credit system. And eventually the spider's legs were going to collapse and the whole economy would collapse with it. And when I saw the title and the cover of your book, it immediately struck me. And you know, it's like, oh, wow, somebody else has had the exact same idea as I did on that. So,
I had chapters in my book that were titled, you know, about the banking spider and so forth. And I had a number of quotes about that. Different people had used that image of it being a spider. And I saw that cover. It was different. It had screaming people who were blindfolded, and the spider actually had hairy legs and fangs and stuff, but it was the Federal Reserve as a spider. I saw that on a website. It was on rents.com, and I thought, wow, that illustrates my book. So I contacted the artist, David Dees, and bought the cover and had him modify it. But I asked him where he got that image, and he said, well, I don't know. It just sort of came to me. So, I mean, I guess he was actually listening to I think it was a David Icke lecture. But, but the thing is, it's just sort of fortuitous.
Well, in your book, you go into the, and we might as well start getting into the meat here. In your book, you go into the Wizard of Oz, and you pick this as sort of a theme of your book. How does the Wizard of Oz pertain to our country's monetary crisis?
Actually, I probably wouldn't have written that book if I hadn't stumbled onto that. But because at first I thought, well, what can I say that other people haven't already said? I'll just be rehashing the same old stuff. But then when I found that The Wizard of Oz was actually written as a monetary allegory in the 1890s, and that William Jennings Bryan, although that whole movement is characterized as being about adding silver to the money supply, I mean, that's what we think he was all about, bimetallism, really, his real thing was he insisted that the money power had to be in the hands of the people, meaning the government, not private bankers. However, so the original movement was 1894, there was a march on Washington, the first ever march on Washington, by a group of greenbackers who was led by Jacob Coxey. And they marched all the way from, I mean, it was a real march. They marched all the way from Ohio to Washington, D.C., ragtag bunch of unemployed men. to petition Congress to go back to the greenback system of Abraham Lincoln, which was during the Civil War, Lincoln issued his own money rather than succumbing to the bankers who were going to charge him 24 to 36% interest. So, and Lincoln, it wasn't even original with him. He was just reverting to the system of the American colonists for 100 years before the American Revolution. In fact, Benjamin Franklin said that what really prompted the revolution was the fact that they had been issuing their own money. The government, their provincial governments had issued their own money, and King George had forbade them to make new issues of money. And that this caused an instant depression because the money supply contracted. And so the farmers were losing their farms. The worst thing was that they had to pay taxes to the British in gold. So they had to pay in a currency they didn't have, which meant, of course, they had to borrow from the British bankers, which put them in debt to the British bankers. So the farmers there were riots and so forth. And so they just went back to using their own scrip, even though they weren't supposed to do it. And that was considered an act of rebellion, and that's triggered the American Revolution. So anyway, the whole 1890s movement was about getting back the power to issue money for the people themselves. So you have these two competing influences, privately issued money versus publicly issued money. And the privately issued money people were taking over, and the publicly issued money people led by William Jennings Bryan was trying to get it back. So the plot of The Wizard of Oz is very strange if you think about it for a children's story. It's like four people marching off to a capital city to make demands on the wizard. Here turns out to be a little man pulling levers and dials and operating a pretend wizard. So that the cowardly lion apparently, well, the tin man, the first there's the scarecrow who represents the farmers who are ignorant of what's going on with their money system, but they're actually inherently intelligent. Then you have the Tin Man, who represents the workers who were out of work and had basically become dehumanized by this whole corporate structure. In the book, the Tin Man keeps chopping off parts of his own body. A curse is put on him because the witch doesn't want him to. This woman that he's in love with doesn't want her to fall in love with him. So. Or she wants to keep them apart, so she puts a spell on him. So he keeps chopping off parts of his own body, and finally he chops out his own heart. So he's just become quite dehumanized by this whole... It's the worker who, the more he works, the more he chops off parts of himself, and that's the nature of the whole interest system, where the more you work, the farther in debt you get. And then the Cowardly Lion supposedly represented William Jennings Bryan, Bryan, you know, it rhymes. And Bryan was called a coward because he was opposed to going to war in the Philippines. And also, I guess, the populists thought he had sort of sold out their money reform issues for, he'd switched over to these international, you know, war issues. So anyway, and then the Yellow Brick Road is the gold standard, which turns out to be an illusion. I mean, it goes to the wizard who's illusory. And then the silver, the real secret is on Dorothy's feet all the time, which is silver, the silver slippers. In the book, the slippers aren't ruby, but silver. So yep. She doesn't know it, but she has the answer all the time.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. Speaking of the gold and silver standard and the yellow brick road and all of this, and that seems to be the dividing line in different policies. First, you have the private sector banking, and then on the reform side, there's two basic fields that I'm beginning to see, and one is the... As you mentioned a minute ago, the nationalization of the money system. And the other one is this movement to go back to the gold and or silver standard. And in fact, you just mentioned a minute ago, G. Edward Griffin, who I've had on my show before, and I've In fact, just yesterday I read an article from him where he was stating definitively that anybody who is for nationalizing the Federal Reserve has completely lost their mind, and that gold and silver is the only way to go. And so, you know, talk about those the two different policies and explain why your position is different or more correct over end. And I have to say first that I agree with you that your position is better than the position to go back after the gold and silver standard, which is what the Wizard of Oz was about.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah. I loved Ed Griffin's book, World Without Cancer, and I loved Creature from Jekyll Island right up to the end till he got the solution. And I thought, that just isn't going to work. And then I found Stephen Zarlinga's book, which I just forgot the title of.
Lost Science of Money.
Oh, right, The Lost Science of Money. And that made much more sense to me. But I had already thought that government should be issuing the money. The thing about going back to gold, it was gold that got us into this mess. Gold was always a ruse. There was never really enough gold to form the money supply. It always had to be backed by paper money. In fact, the gold standard went back to the 17th century when goldsmiths, people left their gold with the goldsmiths for safekeeping, and the goldsmiths would give them these paper receipts for the gold. And people found that they would rather trade the paper receipts because they were more convenient and they were safer to carry around. And then other people would want to borrow gold, but they didn't want the gold either. They wanted the paper receipts. So the goldsmiths soon discovered that they could lend 10 times as many paper receipts as they had gold, because people only came for their gold 10% of the time. So that's where the privately issued money creation came from. It was this ruse that you could always trade in your paper dollars, your paper banknotes, for gold, but you really couldn't, because you could only do it if the other 90% of the people who had a claim to the same gold didn't do it. If they all did it at once, there would be a bank run and the system would fall apart. And that's where we are today, where in the 19th century there were a series of bank runs, and then they came up with the Federal Reserve to backstop the banks so they could get reserves from each other and from the Federal Reserve. And then the FDIC to, you know, backstop the deposits. And now we've gone into all sorts of other machinations to keep the banks going, the derivative scheme. And they figured out how to securitize loans and sell them off so they can make. It's all a scam to keep this pyramid scheme going that's inherently fraudulent. In other words, they're issuing money they don't have. So Ed Griffin would go back to a pure gold system. So let's think about that. The last time I saw, there was $4 trillion worth of gold in the world. So if you, even assuming you could get all the gold, and we have a money supply. Nobody knows what it is now because they're not keeping track of M3 anymore. They're not reporting it. But it used to be like $13 trillion. So even assuming you could get your hands on every piece of gold, you would have to revalue the gold by 400%. So right away, your gold pieces wouldn't represent anything like the real market value of gold. So it's just arbitrary. I mean, you might as well, if you want a fixed money supply, you might as well just have the government issue a fixed number of paper dollars and never issue any more. You don't need the gold at all. What's the point of gold that has no reference to the real money supply? But the other question is, how are you going to get the gold? If you're going to try to buy it from Indians, let's say, who are wearing it, or most gold is in other countries, if you're going to try and buy it from them, what are you going to pay them with? Because your dollars aren't going to be worth anything. So we'd be stuck with only using the amount of gold that's in Fort Knox right now.
And well, wouldn't they just...
Rumors are there's nothing there.
Wouldn't they just do like they had done... historically, and just go and kill the tribe or the group of people that had the gold and take it? Isn't that how they typically acquired gold?
Well, that's the thing. Or they would confiscate it from us, the people who have it in the United States. That's what they did in the 30s. I mean, we gold holders don't really want that. So I think if you like gold, just you keep it for an investment. It's a real good investment. And then if the money, if the dollar collapses, like there, I'll sure it will, although I don't really think it will, but if it does, your gold is going to be worth a lot more. So you don't really need to turn it into coins. Another problem is, Ron Paul would have various currencies, you know, allow gold and allow silver and allow anything else that people want to trade in. But then you're going to have the same problem that the colonists had. You had these different provinces. They had all these different currencies going at once. They'd get devalued relative to each other. The British merchants didn't know what they were getting paid in, and they were the ones that complained to the king and said, this money's being devalued, and it doesn't seem to have any consistent value. So you'd have to, would you allow exchange rates between these different currencies? And what if you had gold coins and silver coins? And what if the price of silver changed relative to the price of gold? Would you change the face amount of those pieces? Or would you just leave them unmarked, and then they would just be worth whatever their market value was? And if you do that, why bother to call them coins? Why don't you just call them gold bars and sell them on the market for their market price? To me, it makes so much more sense to have a publicly issued money that has a stable value of some sort, that's stabilized in some way. I would say it should be stabilized against, it's issued by the government, and so it depends on the rules you impose on issuing it. But let's say the government's only allowed to issue it for real goods and services. That's the old real bills doctrine. Then it would, if the money reflects the money supply, reflects the goods and services in the economy, if it's only issued to create goods and services, you won't have inflation because the money will go up at the same rate that the goods and services will go up. So the price will remain the same. You only get inflation when you have speculation or when you're paying off foreign debts. That's where most of these hyperinflation situations arise, where they have these huge foreign debts that they can't afford to pay, and they can't issue that currency. Like people who owe their debts in dollars and they don't have the dollars, so they have to print their own, like Zimbabwe. They're madly printing their Zimbabwe dollars to get U.S. dollars, and the speculators know that, so they're madly inflating, or in other words, increasing the amount of Zimbabwe dollars that it would take to buy the U.S. dollar, which makes its value inflate horribly.
Let me ask you, as far as you are aware, is there any society in history based its monetary system on gold or silver that didn't eventually get usurped into a form of slavery?
It is said that most slavery came from debt, and that's where the debts came from. That, gold doesn't grow. Originally, the original money, the original word for interest was the word for calf in the Sumerian cuneiform writings. So the original culture that developed all these amazing things and just appeared out of nowhere, and you can come up for all kinds with mystical reasons why that happened. I did start a book on that, but I never finished it. There was this Sumerian, it was a religious state. So the state or the temple basically would lend cattle and corn and so forth to the farmers, and then the farmers would pay it back with interest, meaning a calf, that you would pay back the cows and then you'd pay back an extra calf as interest. Well, the cows actually bred calves, so there was enough to go around. The abundance of the whole economy increased, and so they gave back a portion of that abundance in tithing. But when they switched over to lending in gold, the problem was, and these were the money lenders, you know, the very people that Jesus was so down on and got mad at in the temple because they were charging money for money. I mean, they were charging money for the medium of exchange or usury. Anyway, the goldsmiths or the money lenders were lending these gold pieces, so they'd lend 10 gold pieces to the farmers, and the farmers would have to pay back 11. Well, there just isn't an 11th. There's there's no 11th gold piece in the town. So they would necessarily have to go in debt to the lenders, and then eventually they'd wind up in debtor's prison, and then they'd wind up selling themselves in order to pay off the debt to save the family.
And speaking of ancient Sumeria, in your book, you discuss matriarchal versus patriarchal money systems, and you discuss Sumer in particular. Are you familiar with the work of Wilhelm Reich or Dr. James DeMeo in his book Saharasia on that whole concept?
No, I had read Michael Hudson on that and some other people.
Well, Wilhelm Reich was a psychologist, and Dr. James DeMeo has followed up on a lot of his work. It goes into matrilineal versus patrilineal social structuring of societies and things like that. And I thought that you had cited, was it Hudson or whoever that wrote the book on that? Would you talk about that concept for a minute and how the monetary systems themselves, how they're defined, actually define the structure of the culture as in matriarchal versus patriarchal?
Well, the original matriarchal system was that Sumerian. It had a goddess, you know. So the goddess was Inanna, and then her consort was, I've forgotten. Anyway, in the Sumerian literature,
was it Ishtar, or who was that?
There were the two brothers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you're right. I'm wrong. I'm sorry.
I've forgotten their names.
Me
Enlil
too.
And Enki. Yeah.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Enki was the. There were two brothers in the Sumerian version of the Old Testament story of Noah. There were two brothers. Well, there were these 50 gods that came down, and in the Sitchin literature, Sitchin was a Jewish scholar who noticed all these inconsistencies in the Old Testament, or in the whatever. What's the Jewish version of the Old Testament? Anyway, he was reading it.
The Torah.
Torah, right. He was reading the Torah in Hebrew, and he saw these inconsistencies, like sometimes God was a singular and sometimes a plural, and there was that part where it said the sons of God saw the
world. Oh, that's, you can even see that, and you can even see that. I think I'm getting some feedback from your computer, but you can even see that in the book of Genesis, where he says, become like one of us instead of become like me, when God is talking, or the gods are talking to Adam and Eve there. But
in the Sumerian book, it makes much more sense because there are two of them, and there's
right.
50 gods that come down. Yeah.
Well, if you get into the Gnostic texts, the Nag Hammadi library, there's an entire story there with what becomes the lords in the Bible, and we discussed this in my first book, Astrotheology and Shamanism. But what they show there is that the lords were actually the landlords, and that there were seven of them, and it was the landlords that were banished, and not Adam and Eve.
Interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted you there.
There were the two brothers, and so Enki was. He and his consort actually spawned us. What they wanted, they came here from somewhere else, and they were too rarefied for this planet. And so they wanted a worker race that would husband the, tend the fields, and they had their certain dietary needs that they brought with them. And funnily enough, things like corn and wheat and all that did magically appear in 4000 BC. And nobody's been able to explain that. So anyway, they needed this worker race to do the work, and also supposedly they came for gold, and this worker race was supposed to mine the gold. But they didn't want them to be like gods like them, so they made them half gods. That's us. And they and Enki and his consort actually Inanna took the seed into her body and of the. I guess the highest life form they found here, which was Neanderthal man or something. Or no, it wouldn't be Neanderthal, that's 4000 BC. But anyway, took a a race of human who was not quite gods and mated with them and made this race half gods. And so they would do the work and they would take orders from the gods. So Enki loved the people, and so he was the good god that saw us as his children. But Enlil was—he just saw us as a worker race, and he didn't want us. He didn't identify. It was like cattle. He saw us as a race of, or workhorses or something. And he was the one that got. he thought we were making too much noise, and so he wanted to destroy us with the flood. So he sent the flood, and then Enki sent the boat to save a faction of the people, or it was Gilgamesh, I guess, who was Noah.
Right.
So those two gods were always competing. So Enlil was the god of the, you would say, of the moneylenders, that whole mentality where... And then Enki was the god of...
the people.
Yeah, so...
Freedom.
So Enlil, Enlil got mad.
Sorry.
The Tower of Babel, I guess in the... Was that in Babylonia? The Tower of Babel, where the 50 gods met and they appointed Enki as their leader. And so Enlil got mad and he took his group and they went out and wandered in the desert and vowed to, and they did all this pillaging and so forth. And so that was the angry god of the Old Testament that was destroying all the other villages and stuff.
So let's go back to banking. And why, in your opinion, is it important for the average person to become informed about how the federal money system works?
Most people are clueless. So, I mean, we all grew up thinking that the Federal Reserve is federal, part of the federal government, and that it's the government that issued us the money. In fact, the only money the government issues are coins, which are 1/10,000th of the money supply. All of the rest is issued privately by banks, including the Federal Reserve, which is a private banking. It's owned by a consortium of private banks. There are 12 Federal Reserve branches, and each one is owned by the banks in its area that are Federal Reserve members. So I think New York is owned by 500 banks, something like that, the New York Federal Reserve. So they issue... dollar bills, or more often they just issue accounting entry money. They don't even bother to print the bills. And then they lend that money to the U.S. government, or they lend it to other banks. So it's all a debt. It all comes into existence as a debt, and that's why we have this sort of parasitic pyramid scheme going on where you always have to pay back more money than you... They put out the principal, but they don't put out the interest. So you have to pay back principal and interest. So they put out 10, you have to pay back 11, they put out 11, you have to pay back 12.5, et cetera. So it's this exponential curve of compound interest. And that's why the money supply just keeps growing and growing. So if you understand the system, then you can see what the solution is. And I think, of course, right now that what we should be doing is states should own their own banks, because I think it's going to be very difficult to, nationalize the Federal Reserve or whatever, to act at a federal level, because Congress is pretty much bought and paid for by the bankers, as some congressmen have been saying lately.
Well, it sounds like a really good documentary film needs to be made with your work and with Zarlinga's work and maybe a few other people out there. And get Dennis Kucinich and some other people together and make a solid documentary film, a Showtime or History Channel quality film that we can use to present this information. And it seems to me that, Money Masters is out there, but I think it really
He's
sort of misses
sequel,
the...
Actually.
What's that?
They've got a sequel coming out, or that is out, I guess, called The Secret of Oz. It actually pretty much tracks my book.
Oh, it does. Okay. So, and are they finally getting to the real issue about nationalizing the money? Are they on?
Yeah.
Okay,
Yeah,
great.
I think, yeah. So, but I agree. Yeah, one thing we could do in California is an initiative, but you can just imagine going into grocery stores and saying, you want to sign this initiative for the state to own its own bank. I mean, people would just be clueless because they don't understand
Well,
why there's any improvement.
as somebody who worked on Proposition 215 and the California Hemp Initiative for several years, I perfectly understand what it's like to walk into a store and try and explain to people who think something is an evil drug that has 50,000 industrial uses why they should be signing in favor of it. And, proper education and training and being able to explain well the facts behind it in a succinct way is usually sufficient. And I think right now, in the way things are right now, people are probably more than ever willing to listen.
Yeah. Well, and the way the bankers keep control, this whole private international banking network, is by keeping us all in the dark. It's they've made economics and banking seem so complicated that ordinary people think, well, that's I'll leave that to the economists. That's I can't understand it. And besides, it's boring. I don't want to understand it. But in fact, it's not boring. It's very interesting when you boil it down to its essentials and when you see what's really going on. I mean, it's just so insidious. It's just shocking every time. Like every the reason my book got longer and longer and longer, I just kept coming across as more shocking information that I had to put in there.
So let's go back to the beginning of the U.S. Would you talk about the money system in the Pennsylvania colony and how it worked?
Right. The Pennsylvania model, it was actually the ideal model, and I got that out of Stephen Zeilinger's book. I know you're going to interview him, and he has a certain difference with me on the publicly owned banks, but he said in his book that this was the ideal model. It's the one that Benjamin Franklin raved about, that different colonies had different ways of putting money out there. This is all original with the colonists, so they were all experimenting and they had different experiments going on. The northern colonies, the New England colonies, were tended to just print and spend, and they were the ones that got in trouble for hyperinflating the money supply. Or they didn't hyperinflate, but they definitely were devaluing their currency by putting too much money out there and not taking it back, so it wasn't circular. But in the Pennsylvania colony of Pennsylvania, they came up with this clever idea of owning their own bank. That nobody wanted to come to Pennsylvania because there was no money there, and there was no gold, of course, and they had to borrow from the British bankers at 8% interest. And so the Pennsylvania the province set up their own land bank. It was called the land bank. Supposedly it was backed by land, but it really didn't have anything to do with land. That just was sort of a ruse, like the gold, to make it look stable. And they printed money and lent it to the farmers at a better rate than they could get from the British bankers, who were pretty scarce anyway. So then suddenly everybody started flooding into Pennsylvania because they could get the money to get started. So they would borrow the money and pay it back to the bank. And then to overcome, so it was a circular system and it didn't inflate. And to overcome the fact that there would be a little extra that you would owe in interest that wasn't put out there with the principal, the government itself printed and spent some money, just like the northern colonies were doing. But they just did it in a very modest way, and then most of the money was lent into the system and returned to the province with the interest. So the difference between that and the private banking system was that the interest came back to the public. It was all self-contained. It didn't have this parasitic feeding of profits off the top all the time. And during the time that that system was in place, they paid no taxes because that the interest alone was enough to fund the government plus the bit that they were just printing. They had no government debt because the government never went into debt. They just printed what they needed, and the prices did not inflate. So it was a perfectly sound, stable, ideal system. And other countries have done it, but they don't talk very much about it. It's really, you have to dig and dig to even find it.
So, what you're basically saying is that income tax is completely unnecessary for the government to function?
We never had an income tax until 1913, and then it was very small. The way they got away with it was they made it very small, And then it basically exploded during World War II. No, we don't need an income tax. And you could argue we wouldn't need taxes at all. It just depends on how you structure it.
And here's an important topic that I think is essential to discuss. Would you talk about the 1969 Jerome Daly case? Why is that important to understand?
In that particular case, up till then, everybody thought that that banks were merely lending money, that they would take deposits and then they would take in money and then they would lend out that at a higher interest rate. They'd pay a low interest rate and collect a higher interest rate. But in that case, the plaintiff was also a lawyer, and he challenged a foreclosure on his house, saying that the bank didn't really have the money. There was no consideration for this loan because the bank had merely created the money on its books. Well, that is, in fact, how all banks operate. They do create the credit on their books. They do not lend the depositors money, and they do not lend their own money. They just lend credit. They do it by double-entry bookkeeping. So the president of the bank was put on as a witness, and he admitted that he said, yes, that's what they do. And so Daly won the case, and the judge agreed that it was there was no consideration for the loan. Now, it wasn't really precedent because he was a justice of the peace. You know, it was a different – it was another court system that was set up basically in the 19th century those were the judges that would go around from town to town in the little town. So they were pretty independent, and they pretty much ruled the way they thought things should go. And so you can't really quote it as authority. It's not in the mainstream of, you know, Supreme Court cases or anything, but it was just eye-opening that that the president admitted that that's the way it was done. And there are many authorities who have said so as well. And I mean, it's clearly true now. You can look on the website of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, I think, explains it all, how banks merely create money on their books, and that's what they lend. And even the president said recently in a Georgetown speech, I think in February, he said, people always say to me, where's our bailout? How come you're giving the money to the banks instead of giving it to us? We're the ones that need it. And he said, well, what you have to understand is when we give it to the banks, they can create 8 to 10 times that amount in loans. They can leverage it. So it actually creates money.
Even though he's, by doing that, he's causing hyperinflation and devaluation of the dollar.
If he realizes that, why not give it to his? Why not put it in his own bank and forget about these middlemen that aren't performing?
Right, give the money to the people that caused the entire structural collapse in the first place, being based on dishonesty and trickery and sleight of hand from the get-go.
Right. The FDIC is now bankrupt, so they have to do another assessment against the stable banks to pay the fraudulent banks that got us into this mess. I mean, it's just a mess. And then that's only going to last a couple of months, and then they're going to have to go to Congress. So we, the people, are going to be underwriting this whole corrupt banking system. So why don't we just take it over, and at least we could get the profits as well as the losses. We should be keeping the interest if we're underwriting all the losses.
In our current monetary system, if there was no debt in our society, would there be any money?
No, that's the thing. And if there were no banks, there would be no money, except for those coins that the government issues. Now, what you could do is, if you wanted to outlaw banks issuing credit on their books, then the government would have to step in and issue money instead. And so you could do that. And in fact, I saw that one had a controller of the currency, or I forget, maybe worked for the Mint or something. But he said that you could easily solve the federal debt problem. He says the Constitution says Congress should have the power to coin money. So all you have to do is, well, today you'd do like a 12 $1 trillion coins, just mint them and put. It doesn't say what value you put on these coins. And obviously, coins aren't, the value isn't the value of the metal in them. They're just arbitrarily stamped as a value. So,
you just put
coins, call them $1 trillion each and pay off the debt.
That's great. Well, you know, and that just, I'm sure that's probably a big shock to a lot of people listening to this show. And, you know, it's, how can that be? How is it that for money to exist, there must be debt? I mean, it you know, people really have to get that. If there was no debt, if you and your neighbors and everybody else were completely debt free, there would be no money in circulation based on this current usury private banker system that we have right now. So we can never get out of debt, for if we did, there would be no money unless we change monetary systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not as bad as it seems. It's really only credit. And if you picture it like a huge community currency system, you know how a community currency system works. I belong to one. It's and called Friendly Favors, and it's all computerized, so there's no little pieces of paper or anything. But if you want, say you want somebody to wash your car, and you say, I'll give you, one favor is considered to be the equivalent of $1. So you say, I'll pay you five favors to wash my car, and or 10 favors, whatever. And then, so then you write it up on, in the computer, you know, in your little account that you are minus 10 and so and so is plus 10. So you've just created a debt, but on the other side, the other party has created a credit. So you yourself create the money. When you go to the bank to take out a loan, you actually monetize your own promise to repay. So you always monetize something. Maybe you take your house and you say, I'm putting my house up as collateral, give me a loan. And that's how the bank creates the money. They put the house up on one side. They put the mortgage up on one side of their books. And they count that as an asset to themselves. Say it's $500,000. So you're going to pay them $500,000 over time plus interest. So they call that $500,000 plus. And then on the other side, they have a $500,000 minus, because that's the money that goes into your account. And you're going to draw on that account and probably pay it to the seller. Well, the seller might even be in the same bank. So it could be that that check is just going to move right over into the seller's account in the same bank. So the bank hasn't really lost anything until somebody takes it out of the bank into another bank. But over the whole banking system, it still kind of works out. And then all these new checks become new reserves for yet more money. It's all very complicated, but technically there's a reserve requirement, you know, so you're supposed to have, if somebody makes a $10 deposit, you're allowed to then issue $100 in loans. Now, people will argue with that and say that you're only allowed to issue $9 in loans, but if you look at the Federal Reserve literature itself, that's not what happens. And I've talked to bankers. Here's what really happens. They make loans to anybody they want to who is a creditworthy. Like, say their favorite corporate clients walk in and they want a loan. The bank says, sure, and just writes them the loan. Then every 3 months, the regulator comes around to see if they've met their capital requirement and their reserve requirement. So the banks look, and if they don't have 10% on deposit relative to their outstanding loans, then they borrow some deposits. They can borrow reserves from the money market or from the Federal Reserve. Or the other alternative is they can sell off some of their loans. And in fact, what they tend to do is sell off some loans to their friendly neighbor banker, who's not being audited right then, or, you know, the regulator's not there. And then when the regulator leaves, they buy them back from that bank. So they just keep shifting things around. So that's why the Bank of International Settlements came in with their capital requirement, which wasn't so easy to get around. And that's really what's brought on this whole credit crisis. But that's a whole different issue, but I can go into it if you want.
Well, you know, I was just in the next two or three questions here, I was going to ask you about the IMF and BIS. So why don't you go ahead and go into that now?
Okay, so the capital requirement was imposed in the Basel I Accords and the Basel II Accords. Basel I imposed an 8% capital requirement. So this is real money. This is money of the bank. Normally, it's the money they get from their shareholders. And so that would mean if you have $100 in loans, you have to have $8 in capital, normally money from your shareholders. But it's got all this tier one and tier two. It's very complicated how they do it, and it's all risk-weighted. It depends on how risky the loans are. But typically, it's 8%. So you need 4% tier one capital, which is definitely real money, liquid money. And then you can have another 4%. It's not quite so liquid for the tier two capital. For instance, the appreciation on real estate. Like if you own the bank, you've owned the bank for 100 years, the building. So, and it's gone up in value, you can count that as tier two capital. Well, that's why state banks are in, a state-owned bank is in so much better position. States have a huge amount of capital, so they've instantly met their capital requirement. They have all, they have property like up and down the state, and they've got all those tax revenues that come in, so they have a lot of money. But so then the Basel II Accords, the bank, the U.S. banks, Wall Street banks, had managed to get around the capital requirement by selling loans off their books. So they would bundle up their loans into securities and sell them to investors. So that's why we had this whole great big credit bubble or real estate bubble. They would sell them to investors in Japan and China and Europe and all those people that you hear about now that totally got taken, and bundling up very dodgy loans like subprime loans. But the reason they got the buyers to buy them was they said, well, don't worry, we sold off the risk of default to yet this other set of investors. These would be the derivatives, the credit default swaps, that supposedly protected the loans against default. But the people they sold them off to were like hedge funds, and nobody checked to make sure that they really had the money. So instead of paying up when there actually was a widespread default, they went bankrupt, and that's what brought on this whole credit collapse in the summer of 2007, when two hedge funds went bankrupt and had to try to sell their collateralized debt obligations, and nobody would take them. Anyway, so the Basel II Accords said that you have to value your assets according to what they would fetch on the market today. So like those collateralized debt obligations, the bank, so this is all very complicated, but they're left with a lot of that stuff on their books, and there's really no market for it. So under Basel II, you have to say that stuff's worthless. So that totally impaired their capital base, so the banks then could no longer make loans because they couldn't meet that capital requirement. In fact, if you want to take the conspiratorial view, the Bank for International Settlements is that whole European group, a banker group that goes back for 300 years. It started the whole privatized money thing that is attempting to take over the world, as Amschel Mayer Rothschild said in the 18th century, supposedly, allow me to issue and control a nation's currency, and I care not who makes its laws. That's the whole idea. They want to issue currency privately. So to get control, they set up these Basel Accords, and they're now bringing down the U.S. in the same way they brought down Japan, et cetera.
So this is the real, excuse me, the real mechanism behind the New World Order and how it works and how it's controlled and manipulated, is this entire scheme. Is that not correct?
Right, right. Yeah, and the whole idea, supposedly, according to Carol Quigley, who is a professor at Georgetown University, who is Bill Clinton's mentor and wrote this huge tome called Tragedy and Hope.
Yes.
And he said the whole point, the intent of the international bankers, they had this scheme to control the world, basically, to own everything privately. And they would do it by issuing the currencies of every country, but they would make it look like the government was issuing it, but really they would be issuing it. So they'd make it look like the government by the central bank would be privately owned, and it would print money and lend it to the government. But of course, it would have it would look like national money. It would have the national seal and stuff on it.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Professor Quigley, and actually a friend of mine is in the middle right now of launching a magazine called Tragedy and Hope that is going to have a lot of this type of information on it. Maybe that's something that we can get you to write an article or two for in the near future.
Sure.
So you kind of went into it a little bit already, but could you state more clearly how inflation is created?
Inflation results when you demand goes up more than supply. In other words, demand is the amount of money competing for a good. So let's say you have 10 widgets and $10 competing for them, then the price will be a dollar each. But if you print a bunch of money, so now you have $100 competing for the 10 widgets, that'll drive the price of the widgets up to $10 a widget. They can fetch that much money. You can particularly see that in real estate, because real estate doesn't multiply. You know, it's just there, and so the value goes up as more people are competing to buy the thing. But if you have $100 in new currency and you use it to make 100 widgets, if you put it into a factory that makes widgets, then your price is going to stay stable. So it's really not the fact that you're adding money to the money supply. It's what the money is used for. If that money is put out there as credits to build something that will add to the gross domestic product, then it's fine. You can increase the money supply as long as you also increase the goods and services out there. Usually what causes inflation, hyperinflation, like the Weimar hyperinflation and the Zimbabwe and Argentina and all those different ones, usually it's that they have a foreign debt that they can't afford to pay. And so they start, and their currency is floating relative to other currencies, and it's not pegged so that the price is fixed, but the value of the currency is what it goes up or down depending on how much demand there is for the currency. So if you're, let's say you're trying to pay off your Zimbabwe debt in U.S. dollars, and so you have to buy dollars on the foreign exchange market, well, the speculators know that. Now they know that's what you're up to, and they'll hike up the price of the dollars relative to the Zimbabwe currency, which means you need more and more Zimbabwe currency to buy your dollars, so then you're going to start printing it by the wheelbarrow to buy dollars. In Argentina, in 2000, when they had debts they couldn't pay, and they said, well, we're bankrupt, we can't pay it, and we're just not going to pay it. And then they started printing their own money, but they did it very quietly, and that did not inflate the prices. And then what they did is they bought a bunch of dollars before they said what they were going to use them for. And they just had them stored over here in their treasury. And they bought them by merely printing money. So that did not drive up the cost of the peso, the value of it did not drive down the value of the peso. Then, when they had a whole bunch of money accumulated, they said, okay, we've changed our mind, we're going to pay off our IMF debt. And they did. They used the dollars that they had bought with their pesos without hyperinflating the peso. So it all depends on whether the speculators know what you're up to or not.
So if you're as good at their game as they are, then they won't let you play. But if you outsmart them in their own game, then it's all good.
That's why it's so important for people to understand what's going on. Once you get it, they can't get away with it anymore.
Well, let's shift gears into solutions here. Let's talk about greenbacks. What are greenbacks, and what can you tell us about President Lincoln and his banking policies?
Lincoln, as soon as he got into office, he was faced with a civil war, and there's a fair amount of evidence that it was actually encouraged by the British bankers who planned to recapture the U.S. by debt that they had lost. They had lost the revolution, but they wanted to capture us as a colony again, as they have most of their former colonies they've captured them through this debt machine. So the idea was they already had the South pretty much in tow. The South was busy, you know, feeding raw materials to England, which would then produce the finished goods. But the North was not in that system. And so the idea was to make Lincoln be heavily indebted to the British bankers, which would happen because he needed money to fight a war. But Lincoln refused to succumb to that. He just printed his own money. And it really wasn't Lincoln himself. I mean, it was somebody in Congress who came up with that idea, but Lincoln at least had the foresight to see that that was a way out, and so he agreed to it. And so they printed a bunch of greenbacks, and that is how they got through the Civil War and actually won the Civil War. Not only that, but during that period, there was this unusual period of expansion where they built the railroads across the country, and they did homesteading, the Homestead Act, for where people went out and homesteaded and extended the.
Can I interject something there?
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that without fiat currency and without greenbacks and without the nationalized money that Lincoln created, there would very likely be no United States today. So all of those people out there that are for the gold standard and say that the fiat or nationalized money out of private hands is not the solution, they should think about the fact that our country wouldn't exist if it wasn't for that exact thing that happened historically. Is that correct?
Right. And that was our original system. That was the system we fought for. But we were made to not believe in it anymore. The British hyperinflated the Continental during this American Revolution. And it was really amazing that we won this war merely by printing paper receipts. It had never been done before. They just printed off receipts and said, well, we don't have any money, but we're going to pay you all these receipts here. But the British, as a matter of what war policy, had ships sitting in the harbor that were madly printing Continentals. And so the British actually printed more Continentals than the Continental Congress did. And the Continental Congress was very, this is all out of Zarlinga's book, the Continental Congress was very reasonable in how they just set a limit on how many they were going to print, and they never printed any more after that.
So it wasn't the failure of the money system in itself at all. It was because England had boats sitting out in the harbor printing counterfeit continental dollars, and it was absolutely nothing to do with the dollar itself.
Right, and it was partly because at that time it was easily counterfeited, but we've overcome that.
Well, right. I mean, it wasn't a fault of the money system itself, other than its ease of being counterfeited. It wasn't a problem within the system itself, other than the paper note itself being counterfeited.
Right. And then the other problem was that the Continental had to compete with these other currencies that were more stable. Nobody knew if this Revolutionary Army was going to win. So if you had a choice between taking that currency and taking, well, even one of the, some of the script of the colonies that were more stable and had police and courts and all that to enforce them, or certainly you would take gold over any of that. So that also devalued the value of the Continental. But what really killed it was the speculators went around at the end, and these were the bankers, basically. They went around at the end and they told the soldiers and the farmers, oh, that money's not going to be worth anything after the war, and they bought it all up at pennies on the dollar.
Sell it to us. It's not going to be worth anything. So why do you want to buy it then if it's not going to be worth anything?
Right. We'll take it off your hands.
Have other countries tried or adopted a greenback money system, form of money system?
Yes, but if they talk very much about it, they usually come under attack, and so it's a bit quiet. Of course, obviously, communist China, that's the, I mean, I hate to say that because Hitler did it, the Chinese did it, the Russians did it, and they're all the people that we call our big enemies, but who are we, the colleagues?
Well, maybe that's why they are the enemies, is
exactly.
Because...
exactly.
Yeah.
But
well,
there are littler countries that have done it more quietly, and they haven't come under attack. Like Guernsey and Jersey are these two islands out in the south of England that they have printed their own money for a couple centuries, and it's worked very well for them. They went from Guernsey... to in the early 19th century, their roads were all falling apart, and they seriously needed infrastructure, but they were heavily in debt. So they got this idea, well, let's just print some receipts and pay the workers and call that money. So they did, and that worked, and they got back on their feet, and they don't have hyperinflation. None of those things that everybody says would happen didn't. None of that happened. It's all, the country's doing very well. What they're accused of is everybody likes, they're a tax haven. Everybody wants to put their money in Guernsey because they don't charge taxes. Well, they don't have to charge taxes because they print their own money. So they're being penalized for a system that actually works, or criticized for a system that actually works.
All right. So
Malaysia does it.
What was that?
Malaysia does it. I was actually invited to Malaysia for a conference, and I was sitting next to this businessman on the plane, and I said that it was at the invitation of former Prime Minister Mahathir, and he said, oh, he's very controversial. He says, you know, he built this capital, and the second capital, and nobody knows where he got the money. He says they think it's corruption. It must have been corruption. But it turned out what they did was they actually issued their own money, as well they should. And it worked really well. I mean, the country is just flourishing. It looks great. You would never, it's so, in so much better shape than the Philippines, which is right next door. The Philippines, 80% of their revenues go to pay off foreign debt.
So how come nobody's gone in and bombed Malaysia yet?
Well, they sort of tried, you know, in 1998, there was that whole Southeast Asian crisis that was an attempt to force all those countries that were doing so well on the Japanese money system. They were trying to force them into debt by bringing down their currencies. So George Soros and others went, I shouldn't name names, but anyway, there was a lot of speculation that went on to bring down the currency.
Hugo Chavez, Venezuela, is that a nationalized or privatized money system there?
Actually, he keeps saying he would nationalize the banks, but I don't think that was the one that got voted down recently, right? He tried to get all that into his new constitution, but I think it got voted down.
Yeah, the private bankers and, you know, it's kind of funny because we're talking about nationalizing the Federal Reserve, and he's been nationalizing all of these things because these private bankers and in international financiers have been robbing the country of Venezuela blind as well as the rest of South America. But,
if you talk about nationalizing anything, you'll become on the hit list.
Right. You know, suddenly you're a communist because you're discussing this. So how do you... Speaking of which, what do you answer to people about, you know, oh, well, you're a communist if you say that nationalizing the money system is the right way to go? How do you answer to that?
I always say this is the original American system, and it was stolen from us, and we don't even realize it was stolen from us. We've been brainwashed into accepting a system that is not us. These big private bankers have made us think that we want to support them when we don't need to support them. We can set up a public system that works far, far better. And
yeah.
it's our roots. It's our founding fathers' system.
It basically what they've done is they've been tricked into accepting a fascist New World Order while all the while the fascist New World Order was parading around this fear of communism to keep people from seeing what was really going on.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, the whole notion of the publicly owned banks of Russia, that idea came from, and Hitler got the idea too, apparently, from the American greenbackers. They studied the greenbackers, and they thought, good idea, we'll issue our own money. And then they immediately got, you know, targeted for that.
All right. Let's talk about... Let's talk about some modern-day presidents. Let's talk about Bush and Obama. What do you feel about their presidencies, and where do you feel that their bailout actions are taking America?
Well, bailing out the banks is absolutely wrong, but the one thing that I would say that Obama's doing right, I mean, it's not him, but Ben Bernanke's doing right, is In the spring, February, so he issued $1.2 trillion in new. If you looked at their books, you could see there was $1.2 trillion in new money out there that were obviously it was just money they had created on their books and were lending. Well, $300 billion of that went to buy long-term government bonds. Now that is a good thing. That's what they should be doing. The central bank, the government should go to its own central bank and borrow money from it, basically monetizing its debt, because the Federal Reserve rebates all the interest back to the federal government. What they shouldn't be doing was the other $700 or $800 billion that was going to the banks. They don't need to be bailing out these banks. Set up their own. If it was a publicly owned Federal Reserve or publicly owned banks in general, you wouldn't need to bail out these old, failed, corrupt, this system that can't be saved. It can't be saved. It's the amount of derivatives out there is impossible to clean up on their books. So we should give up on that. Let them go. Let them go according to the same capitalist system that they thrived on for so long. Sink or swim according to the same forces that they got so rich on. And then set up our own public banks that actually will work far better using exactly their rules. We don't have to change the rules at all, because public banks have so much more in the way of reserves and so much more in the way of capital. They don't have to worry about all that stuff that's got the other banks into trouble. And Obama he's definitely an enigma, because when you hear him speak, he just sounds so sincere and, you know, you just want to believe him, but things just aren't working out at all. I mean, they're just going the wrong way. And it seems to me partly he just isn't firm enough. He lets Congress work it out. Well, Congress can't work things out. To work out the medical plan, they're not going to work it out. When Kennedy did the Medicare, he knew what he wanted. And Johnson, I guess, followed him. You would get Congress to work together. You know, you make deals and to make sure that they all vote your way, but you knew what you want. But Obama's just kind of letting them decide, and they'll just, it's the nature of the two-party system that they define their roles in taking down the other side. They're just not going to agree.
I think I told you the other day about my trip to Peru and my stay in the hospital there to get treated for something that was considered uncurable and chronic, and that I would have to take medication for the rest of my life here. And they cleared it up in a couple of weeks down there.
Yeah, yeah. I lived there. I know. I took a parasite remedy. I knew a woman. She was also to get surgery for her stomach just hurts so much, and she's going to get a. Nobody could find out what was wrong, and she was also to get a hysterectomy, and she was signed up for it. And somebody suggested this parasite remedy. It was like $3 over-the-counter parasite remedy. And she took it and, you know, saw this bowl full of worms that I won't describe too much. But it totally cured her problem, and she was just fine after that. So.
What are petrodollars?
The dollar was backed by gold right up until 1933 domestically and 1971 internationally. And then Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard because he had to, because de Gaulle, that's the thing, there was never enough gold to back all the dollars that were out there. And the reason the Bretton Woods system worked was that people were really trading in the dollars, but they had the security of knowing if they wanted the gold, they could go get it, and therefore they never did. It worked as long as nobody really cashed in their dollars for gold. But when we got into the Vietnam War, and it was clear that we were heavily in debt, de Gaulle didn't trust us anymore, and so he wanted the gold. So he took all his dollars to the gold window and cashed them in. And then Great Britain was also to do the same thing, and so that was going to wipe us out. And so Nixon said, sorry, closed the window and said, he took the dollar off the gold standard. And then, that was in 1971. In 1974, Henry Kissinger made a deal, secret deals, according to John Perkins in his book, secret deal with the OPEC nations, saying, I'm going to make you very rich. I'm going to quadruple the price of oil. Oh, this is also in William Engel's book. I'm going to quadruple the price of oil, and in return, you will sell your oil only in dollars, and you will deposit the dollars in our Wall Street banks. and we will protect you militarily. So with that deal, all the dollar then became essentially backed by oil. In other words, you had to buy your dollars, your oil in dollars, and most countries didn't have, or they didn't have enough oil, and so they did have to buy it on the international market. And then when the price suddenly quadrupled, they didn't have enough dollars to buy it in reserve. So then they would have to go to the Wall Street banks to borrow dollars. And that's how they all got locked into, virtually all, you know, most third world countries got locked into debt in to the Wall Street bankers.
And, you know, the sad thing about that, and I read or heard you talking somewhere that they had to come up with the they had to have the oil. And, you know, this is where industrial hemp really needs to come in and be understood, because these countries, most of them, did not need the oil. And, you know, I've got a friend who works at an oil company, in fact, and about a year and a half ago, he tried to take Jack Hare's $100,000 challenge to prove hemp for fuel wrong, and he lost, and actually ended up further proving that the U.S. Could supply all of its oil and energy needs on like 2.5% or 2% of arable land.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, so this is a huge issue that, you know, the whole cover up with marijuana, you know, it's just like the smokescreen with the Federal Reserve. Marijuana was never outlawed because it was marijuana. Marijuana was outlawed because of industrial hemp, because these same bankers that we're dealing with, and the DuPont Company, Andrew Mellon, William Randolph Hearst, and these characters, they saw hemp as a direct threat to their industrial empires, and they're the ones that conspired to have it outlawed, because like William Randolph Hearst, his largest competitor had just invented or had this German inventor invent the decorticating machine that basically revolutionized the entire hemp industry. And hemp is 77% cellulose, and you can grow, you can produce as much paper off of 1 acre of hemp as 4 acres of trees in the same amount of time. And, you know, and cellulose can also be converted directly into methanol and things like that for fuel. So, and this has been proven time and time again. In fact, Exxon owns a process to convert methanol directly into gasoline. And so, you know, when they say that these food crops like corn and things like that don't produce enough to have a biofuel-based system, that's because they're using the wrong crops, and the proper crops have been proved more than a century ago.
Wow, that's very interesting.
In fact, just a week before last, I had Chris Conrad on my show, which you might be interested in. He's the founder of the Business Alliance for Commerce and Hemp and the Hemp Industries Association. And he's also a court expert on hemp and marijuana and things like that. He's testified in hundreds of trials and things. And I suggest you definitely check out his work, as well as his book, Hemp Lifeline to the Future. And he breaks all of that down. Discuss, if you wouldn't mind, and I think maybe we'll hit one or two more things here and then wrap it up. But if you wouldn't mind, would you discuss NAFTA and its effect on immigration?
Well, I did write a chapter on how we brought down Mexico by the reason all these Mexicans are coming across the border to the U.S. is because the peso is not worth anything. I mean, we managed to trash the peso. And we did that, of course, by this whole world trade thing, the whole idea of countries have to open their markets to global trade. That's what the NAFTA agreement is for the North American region. So Mexico had to open up to foreign trade, and then that meant that the speculators from Wall Street came in, and they speculated in the peso, and they managed to actually collapse the peso. And so when the Mexican government couldn't pay back their loans, that's when Robert Rubin got this whole thing passed. Robert Rubin stepped into the Treasury at that point. Before that, he was with, I think it was with Goldman Sachs, which had this huge liability with respect to Mexico. So he stepped into the Treasury and then passed this bailout where the U.S. taxpayers supposedly bailed out Mexico, but Mexico didn't get the money. Who got the money? Were the Wall Street banks that had made the loans to Mexico. So the banks got paid off with taxpayer money. But meanwhile, we caused the Mexican peso, or the speculators caused the Mexican peso to collapse. And so the peso is not worth anything on relative to other currencies. And therefore, the workers suddenly, like if your dozen eggs was worth a dollar, all of a sudden it's worth 20 cents or something. So that puts everybody, they can't make a living anymore. So then they had to come up to the U.S. to try to make some money and send it back to their relatives.
Well, can I interject there?
Yeah.
I wanted to point out that many of the Mexicans that are affected by NAFTA and the free trade agreements and things like that are actually the indigenous people who live off the land, who grow their own crops and things like that. And traditionally, historically, indigenous people, when things run out of supply in one area, they pack up and they move to another area. And they don't, this is really an attack on indigenous peoples once again, just like the 15 million that were killed in this country in the 1800s. But, these people are going to go wherever there is food and supplies, just like tribal nomadic people have always done. And, I just wanted to point that out as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we tend to blame them for flooding up here, but we forced them into that position.
Well, wasn't there somebody back, if I recall, there was this guy back in 92, no, it was probably 93 or 94. And he was sort of a weird little fellow. He ran for president. His name was Ross Perot. Didn't he predict all of that?
I voted for him, but, I was in the Foreign Service then, and I have to admit, I just sort of liked him. I didn't follow the issues very well.
Yeah. Well, he specifically came up with the whole argument against NAFTA, saying that back in 93, 94, that if NAFTA was passed, that we were going to experience a huge wave of immigration, and that was going to have a huge negative impact on the Mexican economy, which it did. And, he actually got it right. Not that I was a big Ross Perot fan at the time, and I don't believe I voted for him. I probably voted independent or something at the time. But, it's this information has been out there, and it's nothing new. And if people read and look up the history, it's already there. People have already warned us about this. Are you certain that? Go ahead.
Countries have been duped into opening up their, well, like China, they had no need to open up to foreign markets to the extent they did. I mean, they've made themselves dependent on sales to us now what they've done, when we're putting all our bailout money into bailing out the banks, they're putting their bailout money into productivity for their people. And that's what they should have done in the first place, was instead of producing stuff for us, they should be producing stuff for themselves. I mean, it's a huge country and they've got all kinds of resources. So that's what every country should do, is work on being self-sufficient, like the U.S. did. That's how we developed in the first place, was we were quite protectionist in the 19th century, and we developed our own resources and our own economy.
Are you certain that I'm getting a little bit of feedback there. I don't know what that's from, but are you certain that people like Adam Smith and, Ayn Rand are incorrect, that greed and the invisible hand will fix the economy?
Well, Adam Smith's Invisible Hand was a little different. I mean, what we have today is not even an invisible hand. I mean, it's a manipulating hand. It's a real hand, and it's really
So
messing
it's
things
a
up.
shadow government more, isn't it?
If it was a real free market, fine, that could actually work. But we don't have a free market. What we think of as the free market is mom and pop stores and farmers who all stake out their plot of land, and they really don't need anybody but themselves, and then they trade independently. But that's not what we have. It's like when North Dakota decided to form their own state-owned bank. All those farmers were very independent. I saw there's a movie on it. It's called Northern Lights. It's a regular Hollywood movie made in the 70s. That they were all speaking Swedish in the movie with subtitles, and they want to have absolutely nothing to do with the movement. You know, none of your socialist stuff or whatever. They weren't getting together with other people. They just wanted to farm their land. But what was happening was they were selling their grains to the granaries. And the granary and the railroad and the Wall Street was all one thing. And the Wall Street bankers were actually trying to get a hold of these farms. And so they weren't accepting the grain when it was perfectly good grain. So then the farmers didn't have any money if they couldn't sell their grain. And so then they would have to go, they were being foreclosed on by the bankers. So they did not want these foreign bankers, foreign to them, you know, outside their state, controlling their money supply. So they decided to set up their own banking system by putting their revenues in their own state bank instead of giving it to the Wall Street bankers.
Seems to me that I remember a number of bankers being shot during that period. Farmers walking into banks and just outright killing them for these tactics.
There's another movie on Bank of North Dakota, and it's made by it's Prairie something, but it's a documentary anyway. And there are all these letters about these poor farmers. They're being foreclosed on, and they write these letters. I don't know why you keep sending me letters. I told you I don't have any money to pay you. I mean, it's pretty pathetic. But they're absolutely strapped and captured.
Ellen, would you like to once again give out the name of your book, your website, any contact information that you would like to provide the audience?
My book is Web of Debt. My website is webofdebt.com. It's also on Amazon, and I've written many, many articles, and they're linked to my website under the Articles tab, and I have a blog that's also linked to my website. And I have another website called ellenbrown.com, and it's got all my other books on it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I really appreciate your time. And hopefully sometime soon we can have you on again to discuss what's new in the economics arena.
Thank you. It's great talking to you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.